warm welcome to another of the North of Scotland Parkinson's Research Interest Group. So we were just having a laugh just before we started. This started off as a pilot study of three podcasts Helga and I said we would do. And here we are a year later and we're still going strong. So thank you very much for everybody who's been listening to the pods and continues to join us. And please feel free to go and look at our back catalogue of podcasts. There's a number of really, really fantastic sessions on there. So we welcome people to go back and look at our prior published podcasts. This podcast, the focus is on something that's really central to many people who live with Parkinson's. And for many people, it's an early symptom, but it's often for many people a symptom that plagues them throughout their time that they have Parkinson's. And this is the issue of sleep. And so to help us navigate through the science and the latest research in relation to this complex nocturnal world, we're delighted to welcome honorary consultant neurologist, Dr. David Breen from the University of Edinburgh. And David is an esteemed researcher as well as clinician. So alongside his clinical work, he's a senior clinical research fellow at the Centre for Clinical Brain Sciences. Gee, glad I've got my teeth in today. And he is also the deputy editor at the Parkinson's Disease Journal and has a number of other roles with Parkinson's charities and with the Scottish Government. And as a result of that, David's work involving the Parkinson's community has taken him all around the UK, it's taken him to Canada. And at the moment, he's back in Edinburgh. So it's fantastic to have a Scottish researcher with us today. So thank you for joining us, David.
Thanks for having me, guys. And yeah, well done on how well the podcast is going. It's it's fantastic.
Thank you. So I'm going to hand over to my trusty wingman, Helga, who is going to get started with the questions today.
Thank you, Julie. I'm going to start right with the basics, David. Why do we sleep and what actually happens when we sleep?
Yeah, I mean, as is often the case, the most basic questions are often the hardest. In terms of why we sleep, there's probably more than one reason, I suspect. I mean, it's probably important because we sleep a third of our lives. So sleep is clearly, pretty critical. I think probably there's two main things that's happening when we sleep. And excuse my voice, by the way, I'm getting over a cold, so I've got a very croaky voice. The first is probably what we might call restoration in the brain. So, during the day, our brain cells are active. And I think the process of sleep probably allows some of those cellular processes to kind of recover. And sleep also seems to be important in clearing some kind of waste proteins from the brain. And there's this newly discovered waste clearance system in the brain known as the lymphatic system that people are quite interested in. So part of it may just be restoration. I think the other part of why sleep's important is learning and memory. I think there's quite good evidence that the laying down of new memories relies heavily on sleep. And there is this concept, which is known as synaptic downscaling. The name doesn't really matter, but as we're awake, our brains are constantly taking in new information, trying to incorporate that information in terms of what we already know about the world and strengthening certain connections within the brain. And actually, that takes a lot of energy and it saturates our ability to learn more. And so sleep provides a chance of the brain to kind of reset. But it does that in quite a selective way and lets the weak connections melt away and lets the strong ones remain. So I think these are, they're two key reasons, I would say. There may be others why we sleep. In terms of how we sleep, I mean, again, what we think is that there is a kind of switch in the brain whereby, the brain networks that are active when we're awake switch to, being less active. And so it's not just the case that the brain kind of switches off, like you might think when you see someone motionless in bed enjoying their rest. The brain's actually pretty active. And this switch is probably driven to some extent by our body's own circadian rhythm, that system that tells us whether we should sleep or not. And that itself is influenced by various things like light and dark. But also the brain has the ability to kind of feed back to itself that it needs some sleep. So I think it's a pretty complex process, I would say.
As Julie mentioned, sleep is a big thing for people with Parkinson's. I certainly, as someone with Parkinson's, sleep is a big issue for me. My body just doesn't seem to want to do it. What are the problems that people with Parkinson's are facing with sleep?
Yeah, I mean, you're not alone, Helga, I would say. I think sleep is probably one of the most commonly reported, symptoms and certainly non-motor symptoms in Parkinson's throughout the course of the condition, not just, in people who've had it for a long time. And I think there's a lot that can go wrong, actually. And part of the challenge is picking that apart. I think most commonly, I think just getting to and staying asleep sleep initiation and maintenance insomnia is probably the most common. But there are other specific sleep diagnoses, if you like, that can happen on top of that. Not in everyone, but in some people. So, you know, some of them that people, you know, recognize, particularly in Parkinson's, are things like REM sleep behavior disorder, where people act out and thrash around in their dreams and can, you know, shout out. Sleep disordered breathing, so things like sleep apnea, daytime sleepiness, restless legs. It's not really a sleep problem, but it happens at nighttime. So some of these things, I think, are consequences of motor symptoms and medications and other things to do with Parkinson's. And some of them are fundamental to the disease process itself. So actually the key issue is working out, you know, when someone says, I'm having a sleep issue, trying to figure out what they mean by that, because each of these things has a different cause and therefore probably a different treatment.
With all these different things that can interrupt your sleep, what is the effect on your body if you are simply not getting enough sleep? And I don't mean the odd lost night. I mean, when it becomes regular and prolonged, week in, week out, month in, month out, year in, year out.
Yeah, I think you're right. There's a lot that can happen. I think if you're sleep deprived, you know, your cognition and often your, you know, certainly attention and concentration is less good. Your mood is less good. People can be more impulsive, and that can happen quite quickly after not that much sleep deprivation. I think if we talk about more severe and prolonged sleep deprivation, you know, it's certainly the case that sleep deprivation is believed to increase the risk of certain metabolic disorders, so obesity, diabetes, even certain cancers. There is an intriguing possibility, and this is by no means proven, but I think it is an intriguing thing, and I'm interested in this, is whether sleep deprivation in people with Parkinson's could alter the course of their disease in some way. And it could do that by increasing, you know, neuronal activity in the brain, which might be detrimental. It could prevent the drainage of these pathological proteins. And there's some evidence coming through now from my group and others that that may be the case. And that's exciting because it could represent a kind of novel treatment target almost, if you want to regard it as that. So yeah, there's definitely wide-ranging consequences of sleep loss.
So just going from that then, it's, you know, a lot of people complain of, well, I suppose a lack of sleep rather than sleep as such. A lack of sleep is an early symptom of their Parkinson's. Do you think there's enough evidence to suggest that sleep may have an indication of the journey that people are going to experience as part of their Parkinson's? Do we notice a slightly different phenotype in those people that have sleep disturbance, or is it too early to say?
I think it's probably too early to say with certainty, Julie. There are certain aspects of sleep. So for example, people with REM sleep behavior disorder, there may be a more rapidly progressive rate of change over time. And that's come out through various studies. It does seem to be the case that people with very disrupted sleep architecture and certain changes in their sleep architecture also have a more rapid progression. To what extent that reflects a shared underlying neuronal damage, or that sleep is actually causing the more rapid progression, I think is unclear. I think it's an exciting area, though.
With that in mind, just hallucinations and all the other things aside, but simple insomnia in people with Parkinson's, is it different from insomnia in the general population then, that the reasons for it are different?
I think some of it's probably different. Some of it may be, you know, exacerbation of possibly things that happen with, you know, normal getting older. So, I mean, we know when we get older anyway that the amount of time we spend in kind of, you know, stage three sleep, which is a good proxy for kind of restorative sleep, gets less anyway. Melatonin output gets less anyway. So to some extent, Parkinson's may cause those things, but just more. But there does seem to be additional fundamental changes to the kind of sleep and circadian rhythm that happens. That's something I've been interested in for a number of years now and done a fair bit of study on. Not to mention the impact that other Parkinson's symptoms have on sleep. Just, you know, normal things like difficulty moving in bed at night, bad tremor, pain, you know, even nocturia, you know, even psychiatric type symptoms. You know, all of these things can have a bearing. And so it's trying to work out in that individual in front of you what the main driver is that I think is important. Quite challenging, though.
We all know the sleep hygiene. Anyone who suffers from any kind of sleep problems knows all the sleep hygiene things. A little bit more complex than that. What treatments are there possibly?
So yeah, I figured that'd be something that people would be interested in. And perhaps I'll touch on a few areas. I'll leave the kind of drugs to the end, because that's often what people want. And I understand why, that there must be something I can take to make you sleep. And there are certain sedatives and hypnotics that seem to put you to sleep. The question is, you know, do they put you into the right type of sleep and how restorative that is? I mean, we talked about before the boring things that we all know we should do, but probably don't. And I do think it is important to kind of touch on them briefly for people, because I think they shouldn't be disregarded, because all these small things add up. I mean, first, three things then. First is avoiding things that aggravate good quality sleep. So, you know, people, if they're having nocturnal wearing off symptoms that are dopamine responsive, whereby people are having difficulty moving in bed and so forth. Actually, some slow-acting levodopa at night or a long-acting agonist like a reticotine patch can actually be helpful. And people may not even volunteer that they're having those nocturnal offs, but that may be happening. And there may be other symptoms like nocturia or, as I say, other non-motor symptoms that are driving some of the sleep issues. I think also just, again, it's the boring stuff, but, you know, in people taking selegiline and amantadine, for example, not taking them late in the day, they can be alerting at night, avoiding caffeine, alcohol, large meals, diuretics, you know, avoiding these things late in the day, you know, they seem kind of really obvious and easy, but unless you actually look at them, sometimes it is these finer things that are important to pay attention to. Second are the kind of dreaded sleep hygiene things that we spoke about. And these are, as I say, the boring things that we all know we should do. But actually, these things do add up. And actually, a kind of CBT, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy style approach to dealing with sleep may be as, if not more effective in some people as medicine. And actually, the medicines we have for insomnia aren't actually necessarily all that good. So the things that we all know, so regular bedtimes, dark room, comfortable temperature, avoiding bright lights, so TVs, iPads, you know, suitable mattress, you know, et cetera. These things are all important. And actually, for people who are interested, who are listening to the podcast, some of these things are incorporated now in these digital sleep packages like Sleepio, which people in Scotland can access for free. And I think elsewhere in the UK as well. And I'm sure there's other ones as well. So it is worth people looking at that and just thinking about the factors that may not be helping. I mean, finally, in terms of medicines, I think there's a couple of randomized trials now showing the benefits of melatonin supplementation in Parkinson's. It's an off-label use, but it's safe and easy to try. And definitely people with that more pure sleep initiation or maintenance insomnia, not going to help certain other aspects of sleep. You know, if you're having difficulty moving in bed or tremor or things like that, but it can be useful. I think it's the case that some people want and rely on hypnotic and sedative drugs. And that's a reality of where we're at right now with sleep medications, that people rely on Zolpidem and temazepam and these kind of drugs, which, let's be honest, you know, are addictive or can be addictive, but can help people sleep, even though the quality of the sleep may not be as good. But actually, some people do require that. I think you'll always have to try the other things clearly first. In some people where you're maybe thinking about giving a mood stabilizing medication, if people have depression, for example, you can sometimes use the almost side effects or the sedating quality of some of those drugs to your advantage. So drugs like mirtazapine or trazodone can actually be helpful. There's other things that people have used, which I generally don't, at least not in my routine practice. You know, you'll hear people talk about sodium oxybate, which is a drug that can be given for insomnia, but very high salt content, can't be given to people with hypertension, really, or heart failure. And in our patient population, it's probably just not, generally speaking, the best drug. Can also cause other side effects. So I'll be honest, it is a big unmet clinical need of having better medications. And I think there are other things being developed that are more fancy. So things like, you know, orexin antagonists, there's other classes of drugs that, you know, I think will come in the future. But at the moment, I think it's a multi-pronged approach, you know, avoiding things that are worsening sleep, thinking about sleep hygiene, and then thinking about medication. I think it is all three of those things.
One of the key things that often there's dispute between couples, so one with Parkinson's and one without Parkinson's, should they sleep during the day or should they keep awake during the day and save their sleepy time for the evening? And this is always a difficult one between couples because in some ways I could see the merit in both sides of that argument. Is that, again, from the sort of sleep literature out there, is sleep snacks during the day a good idea or can that have the problem of reinforcing negativity in terms of habits?
That's what this is about. I mean, these are the important questions that people ask us. And it touches on, you know, daytime sleepiness being a real and probably a separate issue, even though there obviously is a relationship between if you sleep badly at night, it probably impacts on the daytime too. But there probably is a fundamental daytime sleepiness that occurs in Parkinson's, probably due to loss of orexin neurons and other things. If you're having long, unpredictable naps during the day, that's not going to, you're going to disrupt your circadian rhythm. It's going to be difficult to kind of have a nighttime and a daytime and have a regular sleep pattern. And so in people with really quite severe daytime sleepiness, where if they were allowed to, they would sleep for hours, and that can happen, especially in dementia with Lewy bodies or people with more advanced Parkinson's, that can happen. I think that can be problematic in terms of nighttime sleep, and then you get into other issues at nighttime. So I generally, you know, would advise people not to have very long sleeps during the day. In terms of regular short naps, I don't see that as a major problem. I don't think it's the end of the world for people to take a kind of a regular short nap. If you've tried to address nighttime sleep issues, if you've tried to reduce the dose of dopamine agonist that we know can aggravate daytime sleepiness, you know, and people are still finding they're very, very sleepy, I think short, predictable, same time of the day-ish, you know, regularized naps, I think that can be beneficial. It can help that daytime sleep and just allow people to enjoy the day more. And the main issue is just the knock on, not being able to sleep well at night. But as long as they're short and regular, I think that's probably fine. Because generally speaking, it's quite rare I give medications for daytime sleepiness. So people talk about drugs like modafinil and so on. I rarely give drugs like that. I have done, but it's rare. And there is emerging therapies like bright light therapy. So there's trials now around bright light therapy, so light boxes used for daytime sleepiness. And I think that's something we'll probably hear more of. Whether or not people have to buy it themselves or it's funded in the NHS is another matter. But I think we will hear more about that. But yeah, in answer to your question, if it's a short nap, I'm pretty relaxed about that.
In the lucky event that you get a good night's sleep, do you believe that sleep benefit exists?
Yeah, I've no doubt it exists, at least in a proportion of people. And so sleep benefit, as you say, is that, you know, that feeling that even sometimes, despite taking the morning medication, particularly early on in the course of Parkinson's, that people have a boost in their motor and other abilities. I think that exists. What I think is less clear is exactly what's going on in the brain to cause that. Is that some kind of replenishment of the dopamine stores or something else? But no, I think it's real. At least in a proportion of people, definitely.
I think it probably highlights the complexity, isn't it? I mean, many of us feel refreshed after, you know, a good night's sleep. And is that partly psychological because you know you've had a good night's sleep? Is it? And I think that's when it becomes really challenging, is in order to be able to sort of measure sleep. And that kind of leads me on to sort of my next question. And I think sleep obviously is quite a complicated area of research really to explore and to investigate. What are some of the challenges you found within your research in terms of exploring and researching sleep amongst people with Parkinson's?
I think one challenge is actually for a long time, sleep medicine amongst doctors is quite a kind of unsexy area. It's actually not that fashionable. And actually sleep medicine is a kind of an emerging specialty, actually, you know, partly full of respiratory physicians and some neurologists and some non-specialists dealing with sleep disorders. So I think that's a challenge. I think also some people just regard, you know, individuals and care partners also regard, you know, sleep issues as inconsequential sometimes and don't necessarily, you know, deem them as important. And especially if someone doesn't have a, you know, bed partner, I mean, actually no one sees what's going on at night. So I think there's some challenges. I mean, the other is the challenge of just how do you actually go about assessing sleep aside from asking questions about it? do you bring someone into a sleep lab and hook them up and measure their brain waves and look in detail at their sleep architecture and so on? Do you have some kind of a home setup, which can be appropriate for the investigation of some sleep disorders? Do you rely on kind of some wearable devices that, you know, people are obviously quite into now? And I think we will hear more about that. So wearables to look at sleep fragmentation at nighttime. Do you just rely on questionnaires? So I think it depends on the question you're asking to some extent. I mean, ultimately what matters is how people feel they sleep. That's what matters is how people feel, as opposed to necessarily what's going on. Although what's going on in terms of brain, sleep architecture obviously has implications in terms of, you know, the pathology and so on. So I think there are some of the challenges. It's just, you know, making sure that doctors and patients know that this is an important area, it has consequences, and just having, where appropriate, the right resources to investigate these problems. You can't send everyone to a sleep lab, and you wouldn't want to, but having the ability to do that where it's important, I think is important.
Just going back to the simple things, does everybody need a different amount of sleep? Is it a very individual thing, or is there a particular amount of sleep that we would all aim for or hope to be getting?
I mean, we're supposed to be aiming for 7-8 hours. I mean, I certainly, many of us are miles away from that, at least most of the time. I think most people probably do need that or in and around that. I'm sure there is some individual variability, whether that's, you know, in their genetics or something else. You know, there's famous people who, you know, got away with less sleep. And actually, it's almost this societal thing that getting away with less sleep, almost like it's something to be avoided, you know. And you sometimes hear that. It's almost, you know, you've accomplished something if you get away with, you know, less sleep. You know, it's serving an important function. And I think we probably should prioritize it more than we do in society. And I don't speak from any position of any good position here. I'm as bad as anyone. I think life takes over.
But I think that also recognises the complexity of it, because I suppose different age groups perhaps are slightly more sensitive to a sudden loss of sleep. So perhaps, perhaps when you're slightly younger, you could perhaps manage a late night out, say, for a social event at the weekend. But certainly I am getting older, and I'm finding my ability and recovery I'm not always so fresh the next again day. And it just, as I'm getting older, I think, you know, you become less resilient to sudden losses in sleep. And I suppose that coinciding with perhaps Parkinson's on top of that, as we're all getting older, our ability to deal with changes in sleep pattern becomes less sensitive, or becomes more sensitive, and you're more vulnerable to that.
A lot of people have looked at sleep duration as a risk factor for later life degenerative disease, whether that be Alzheimer's or Parkinson's. And actually, it's often quite hard to unpick in terms of what is the potential risk factor versus what is the consequence of an emerging degenerative brain condition. And I think it is a real challenge. But no, I agree. I think it's a moving target as we get older, in terms of the amount of sleep we need and that we get.
Can I just go back to something that you did briefly mention before? We've talked a lot about amount of sleep and whether you are or aren't able to sleep. Can we just look a little bit more at some of the more possibly distressing or frightening consequences of sleep when we're talking about hallucinations and things like that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, there's a lot that happens at nighttime, and people with emerging cognitive and neuropsychiatric symptoms and Parkinson's, often those symptoms come more to the fore at nighttime. You know, this kind of, you know, so-called sundowning, where, you know, at nighttime, especially, you know, when the brain's playing tricks and misinterpreting shadows in the corner of the room or something, that people can have more in the way of hallucinations. And that can especially be the case during kind of sleep transitions. You know, so when people are kind of falling asleep or waking up, you know, we talk about sleep as a kind of on or off phenomenon. You're either asleep or you're not. But in reality, you know, different parts of the brain are, quotation marks, waking up at different times. And during this transition, you know, the brain probably isn't playing ball completely, and it's misinterpreting things. So I think hallucinations and confusional states, not in everyone, we know that, but in some people can be very disruptive, and trying to help I think is key to allowing people to sleep, and allowing people to sleep probably helps those symptoms. And I think these things can go hand in hand. So, yeah, I think there's a lot that goes on. You're right, absolutely right. There's a lot that goes on at nighttime that's not just sleep. I think these other things are crucial, you know, and very important too.
So perhaps one of the last questions, just want to, we have touched upon this already, is what do you, or what do we know about the difference between poor nocturnal sleeping and daytime sleepiness? Is there a difference in the underlying pathophysiology, or again, is it a combination of the pathology and behaviour? Is it a cause of medication? What's, are they separate or connotations of the same thing?
Yeah, I think they are separate, but obviously there's a relationship between them. But I think it is important to think of them and assess them as separate things, even though bad nighttime sleep will obviously make you more sleepy during the daytime. But I think it is the case, and good evidence, you know, that loss of particular types of nerve cell, so particularly orexin neurons, so these are the neurons that are also lost in things like narcolepsy. So there is a disproportionate loss of orexin neurons in Parkinson's that is highly likely to be important in the kind of hypersomnolence or excessive daytime sleepiness that people have. I mean, as well as that, I think I touched on it before, it's certainly the case that people can be made more sleepy by the medications they're taking. So, you know, you'll be aware, probably all dopamine replacement drugs, but particularly agonists, can aggravate daytime sleepiness. And, you know, when these drugs came out, there was instances of kind of daytime sleepiness and even kind of sudden sleep attack that could happen. And there was kind of, you know, medical legal challenges and so forth. So, you know, there are things that can make daytime sleepiness worse that we need to warn people about if we're starting these drugs. And we need to think about sometimes taking, you know, reducing these drugs. And daytime sleepiness is important in itself, because we think about, you know, the risk of car crashes, for example, and people who are drowsy and sleepy. You know, as doctors and you know, other specialists now, when we get the DVLA form to complete for people with Parkinson's, you know, the things that they're worried about are obviously motor function and unpredictable fluctuations, but more so than that, almost significant daytime sleepiness and significant cognitive impairment are the things that I think pose the biggest risk. So, you know, I think it is important in its own right.
Particularly with relevance to daytime sleepiness, can you define for me the difference between fatigue and tiredness?
I'm very careful in clinic when people say they feel tired to try and work out what they mean by that, because what some people mean is a general body fatigue, that their body just feels tired. So that's fatigue, and that's its own thing. Some people feel like constantly at risk of kind of dozing off in situations that they should normally doze off. So that's maybe okay if you're watching TV, but it's maybe not so okay if you're sitting at the traffic lights or in the middle of eating a meal. So that's excessive daytime sleepiness. But throw into that other things like apathy. Okay, you should be able to tell apathy apart from these other things. But actually, I think these things overlap quite a lot. And I think people sometimes don't spend enough time just trying to pick apart what people mean by, you know, tiredness. And I think it differs from person to person, actually.
I think you're absolutely right. I think they all get put in the one basket, don't they? And it's really difficult to delineate between those, and people, and it depends, different people hold different perceptions of what that is. So I just want to sort of kind of end with probably the $1 million question. Where do you think the next avenues are that we need to be looking at to research sleep in more details, or where are the next big wins in relation to that for Parkinson's?
Great question. So I think two things, really. One is that there still is a massive unmet need for drug and non-drug approaches to deal with both, you know, nighttime and daytime sleep disturbance. So I talked about some new classes of drugs that I think will find the way to the clinic in time, and there may be others. So whether that be orexin antagonists or other drugs that somehow kind of boost the circadian rhythm in some way, those drugs are in development and are kind of being trialed now. So I think that is going to be important in the years to come, and is crucially needed, because I think that, yeah, there's a big unmet need. I think there is a massive question still on whether sleep deprivation in people who already have the disease. So we know disease causes sleep problems, but does sleep problems accelerate the progression? And how does it if it does, how does it do that? I think that is that's another question. And also just more broadly, and it's probably, you know, less pressing, but to what extent the identification of early sleep problems as an early prodromal marker will play into the early identification of an emerging brain condition. You know, rightly so, REM sleep behavior disorder has got the most attention as an identifiable sleep phenotype that if you leave people long enough, people will almost always develop a kind of brain condition, whether that's Parkinson's or MSA or dementia with Lewy bodies. And actually other sleep problems probably are early prodromal markers as well, actually. It's just that they're also more common in the general population. And so it's hard to use them as actual, you know, early diagnostic markers. So it will be interesting to see how the diagnosis of Parkinson's changes as we look to diagnose people earlier and earlier. And that will become even more relevant when we do find these modifying therapies, which hopefully won't be too far away.
You know, I mean, that's a fantastic answer. And the reason why I'm smiling is that, you know, we've now done over a year's worth of these podcasts, and each of them has a common theme, despite the diversity of the topics, is that the complexity of conducting research, but due to the heterogeneity in the condition, but also the research has really pushed our knowledge and understanding of Parkinson's. But at the same time, it's raised more questions than perhaps answered questions, which I understand must be frustrating for those who are living with the condition. But it also does equally call for the need for large sort of longitudinal studies, doesn't it? Where we're looking at the Parkinson's population, where we can look at, well, what are the prognostic prodromal factors? Is it sleep? Is it low mood? Is it, you know, cognitive issues? What is driving it? Is it dietary factors? And, you know, all these different factors and that need to follow people up over time to explore what the impact, because actually there's a lot of unanswered questions as a result of our greater understanding of the complexity of the condition.
No, I totally agree. And just finally, I mean, it's also just the challenge of having the time and space for people to be able to tell you about all the various things that aren't just their motor symptoms. And we know this, that non-motor symptoms sometimes have historically been neglected in short clinic appointments. Now, I think that is happening less, but obviously time remains short in these appointments, and finding tools that allow people to articulate the key motor and non-motor issues they're experiencing, I think continues to be a challenge, and will do as the, you know, whilst the NHS is as stretched as it is and clinics are so busy. But I think these are things that we should prioritize, because we know that not only sleep disturbance, but lots of non-motor symptoms have a big impact on quality of life, particularly as time goes on. You know, we know this. And yet, you know, we still see some people just focus solely on the motor stuff and the dopaminergic medication alteration. And as we know, Parkinson's is so much more than that.
Wow. Thank you so much for today's conversation. I feel it's a bit of an indulgence doing these podcasts, because I equally learned so much from coming to them. But, you know, I think there's some real positivity in relation to sleep. Yes, it's an emerging area. Yes, it's an area perhaps we haven't spent a lot of time focusing on. But equally, there is some ways that people can help themselves to perhaps improve their sleep hygiene. And but also that, you know, there is some approaches that we can support people to try and make those improvements. But there's probably still a lot of work to do within this area.
Yeah, but it's not, I totally agree. It's not hope, you know, that people with sleep issues, it's not a kind of hopeless cause. I think there's a lot to do. Some of it's the boring stuff we know we should do. Some are a little bit more sophisticated, but I agree there's more to do as well. But no, I think we need to be proactive in going after trying to treat these issues. So no, I've really enjoyed the chat. Thanks, guys.
Thank you so much.